Hang about. It's our weekly catch-up with the National Party's Denise Lee.
Now, I've already done the usual hellos, Denise. What have you been up to today?
I've actually, shout out to Politics 101 class with Professor Tim. I've just come from there.
Oh, exciting.
So I went and talked to a couple of hundred students right here on campus about what it's like to be an MP, an electorate local MP, how selections run, all kinds of amazing questions. It's a really fun experience. Loved it.
Wow, that sounds amazing. Did you walk away from that seeing young people engaging in politics and like having hope?
Well, it was a political science class.
Yeah.
So they're kind of already there.
They're already there, yeah.
But we did actually talk about lack of engagement by young people. So one of the, I think, a real big issue for New Zealand. I gave the example of my year 13 daughter's school class. They were all lined up, they all filled out their voter enrolment forms, they're still 17, and not everyone, in fact hardly anyone, actually handed their voter enrolment forms in.
Oh wow.
And the teacher was really upset afterwards. So somewhere we've got to do better.
Yeah, definitely. I guess we'll jump straight into it in terms of student fees. Yep. Student fees free policy. So a survey conducted among Canterbury University students. Can you tell us a bit about what that survey was?
Yeah, so they it was published in the New Zealand Journal of Educational Studies, and that study showed that 65% of those surveyed, the policy of fees-free had no influence on them. They were going to study anyway. So that's a big chunk, 65%. Some influence was about 28%, but here's the real kicker. Only 6%, in fact 5.8%, said that the fees-free policy had a lot of influence in them going to studies. So you've got to ask some serious questions about whether the fees-free policy is doing what it should do, doing what Chris Hipkins, the minister, said it would do. That study is quite harrowing, really.
So one person who spoke up about this is James Ranstad, who's from the New Zealand Union of Students Association. He said that he believes the problem with that study is it was conducted at Canterbury University. And he believed that if you conducted the study at Waikato University or AUT, the results would have been different. What do you think about that?
Well, that may be so. That's a fair comment. It's a contextual, obviously, study. But what we do know is that there are 2,400 less students in tertiary and in training than there was a year ago. So that number alone should tell you something about the success or the non-success of this policy.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think it might have been based in Canterbury University, but hey, people are... I think it shows that if they were going to study, they were going to study.
Yeah.
So has there been this big rush to take advantage of the government's $2.8 billion very expensive policy? You could argue not. We've got less students. We've got only 6% saying that policy influenced them strongly. For a number of reasons, I think people were just going to study anyway, and this hasn't helped grow our tertiary pie.
I suppose there is a side of this in terms of talking about the barriers to getting into study. Like there are, usually it's a problem of socioeconomic barriers for people, people who might be able to justify having the student loan but cannot really be supported to get their way through a degree. I'm curious what your thoughts are on that.
Well, absolutely. There are students who need assistance and support to get in there. But if this was the panacea, if this was the big idea, why isn't it working? A year on, and respectfully, I think people have waited for it to be a year on. I'm on the Education Select Committee, and we started to ask questions about 6 months in, but we all, if I can use the term, backed off and thought, nah, let's wait for a year. And here we are starting to get demographic figures through, and it's not showing up the success story that it should for a very expensive policy. And you've got to ask yourself, Laura, if you're going to spend $2.8 billion there, where's the trade-off? How about the other tertiary policies and measures that are coming through that require some funding and some relook at funding. We've got ITOs and polytechnics and the seismic shift happening there. Priorities.
I was kind of looking into this from an economics perspective because that's what I tend to do. I like to think about it that way. And of course, student debt has been growing economically growing massively for quite a long time. I believe it's in 2015, 540 people with student loans declared bankruptcy. In 2017, we saw student loans ballooning at 37%. And then with a greater increase to student loan, student fees in the first place. And then on top of that, and it's just last year, actually, the top 10 student loan borrowers in New Zealand, they owed each $370,000 in debt. And obviously that is going to have an economic impact on people and their spending ability. I'm curious what you think about that.
Well, absolutely. Taking on debt has the impact personally, and we'd all love to avoid that, but sometimes debt's necessary. So when you embark on tertiary education, you're investing in yourself, right?
Mm-hmm.
Most often in life, nothing comes for free.
Yeah.
And even with this new fees-free tertiary, it's not like your entire tertiary experience is now covered.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're going to invest in yourself, Laura, then that will inevitably come with some financial impact. Student loans are interest-free, so we still have that, and that's a real benefit. We'd just argue that the policy of fees-free needed to be thought through in terms of where it's being spent, how it's being spent, and then even the fact that it's going to be doubled down with a second and a third year coming in soon. You've got to trade off. Money doesn't grow on trees.
No.
Where's it going to go? And now we're starting to see some other big policies coming in across the tertiary sector. And I would say that Chris Hipkins has got some serious prioritisation. We've got a budget coming up in a couple of weeks.
Mm.
Let's see what happens there. But I would say that they're looking at their $2.8 billion campaign promise and investment and saying, ouch, this is very costly.
I'm going to shift on to semi-automatic gun exemptions that National has been talking about. So can you explain a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so we haven't called for exemptions other than the sporting community issue, right? So we've supported the legislation, and there's been a real collaborative exercise.
Mm.
Parliament's worked well together, so we went through our second and third reading this week, and there's some really good debates. It's quite hard it's very hard and difficult to pass legislation that fast. So hats off to the Finance and Expenditure Committee that shepherded it through. But there's never going to be a perfect outcome.
Mm.
So we've had to be really careful. So we have asked, and we put in an amendment, which was voted down, to look at allowing the international sporting community competitions to have another look, and we weren't able to do that. We think that it shouldn't be too difficult. Well, let's put it this way. Stuart Nash has said we'll look at that in the second tranche. So why haven't we looked at it in the first? How difficult can it be to look at some of the licensing around and the issues around, like, for instance, pistols right now? They're quite strict. They've got their own special carve-outs, I guess you could say. So why can't we apply some of those carve-outs to the international shooting sport category? We thought there could have been a little bit more work on that, but instead it was sort of kicked off to the second tranche, and we're saying maybe we could have worked a bit harder on that. The other is the firearms prohibition order. So we talked about this last week.
Yeah.
That was the other big issue for us. We don't understand why, when you've got known serious gang members who have had convictions recently, why can't the police, they've said publicly, the gangs have, that they're not going to hand them in, so why can't we allow police to do what they do and go to known violent offenders and say, we know you're stocking them, you're stockpiling, and we're going to take them off you.
I guess one of my concerns about that, though, is you're saying known offenders, and at what point are you saying, what evidence do you have at that point?
Well, so police would have to go through the correct tick box order. Mm. So they can't just willy-nilly show up to any old person's house. They'd have to be known offenders, and I'm pretty sure it's within the last 10 years have had convictions, and convictions of certain natures. So there is restrictions around it, and there is, you know, administrative, I guess, processes that police would have to go to. But they still need the tools to be able to go search, and it is a little bit more, I guess, intrusive than what is currently there, but it's for a very good reason. If you've got gangs going public now saying, we're stockpiling and too bad, why would we just sit back, especially if we've gone to all this trouble to get a new regime in, and we just sit back and let them have their own space? That doesn't sit well with me.
Mm. I can see both sides of it, but also in terms of like I actually personally live in a gang suburb, like gang territory, so and I've grown up around guns my entire life. I've competed actually in sports shooting.
Oh, have you?
Yeah, I trained in biathlons in Canada, so that's skiing and shooting.
Oh, you could have written that little amendment for us, Laura.
I guess the thing is, as someone who's been around guns and the conversation around guns my entire life, most of the people that you hear from keep guns because of anxieties around other people, anxieties about people coming in and offending them in some way. And I think there's kind of two problems in terms of like you have 10 years for this person who has come out of prison and is trying to reform their life and then never really getting freedom in that sense. And then on the other side of that, someone who is potentially feeling anxious in their own home and is looking to defend themselves. Not that I'm saying people should keep semi-automatic weapons, but I'm just trying to expand the conversation beyond just we hate gang members or...
I can't see any context in which a gang member with convictions stockpiling guns could ever be acceptable. I wouldn't believe for a second that they're stockpiling a gun to protect themselves. Mm. They'll possibly from another gang member, but I wouldn't think for a second that there'd be good intentions for violent, known, convicted gang members having semi-automatic weapons. That's a no.
I think when we speak about gang members, oftentimes, though, it's a dehumanizing way of talking about them. And we distance the fact that gang members have feelings and have grown up in certain environments and potentially have trauma and are people at the end of the day. What do you think about that?
Oh, second chances. Absolutely, Laura. Mm. Every human deserves a second chance. There's no two ways about that.
Yeah.
I just don't think there should be a second chance if they're stockpiling semi-automatics. We've just passed a law that said no New Zealanders, hunters, farmers, they can't have them, so why can gangs? That doesn't stack up.
Yeah, I guess my big issue is the invasion into someone else's house, but I might just shift on to our last subject. the census data. So we saw that 700,000 people did not complete their census.
That's big.
Yeah, that is a big deal. So why do you think this is the case?
1 in 7 people didn't do it. Look, I don't know, but I think that the Minister for Stats should speak up. I've seen a passing of the buck, stats departments getting blamed, the ministers getting blamed, but this is actually quite a big deal. I don't know if it sort of gets up to the top of the list of 10 most sexy topics in New Zealand, but it should, because this is how we allocate money in budgets to government departments. This is how electoral boundaries, this is affects me, are drawn up. It's via population. So if we don't know who's in New Zealand, just think when you go to ethnic, to understand the ethnic makeup of Auckland and our suburbs, if we get it wrong, we get it wrong. How are we supposed to allocate funding and know where to invest in communities and people and departments if our stats are all off. So somewhere the government and the Minister of Stats, James Shaw, they've got to actually fess up and say, we've done this wrong, we've dropped the ball. We've been accused of starting the process when we're in government. Sorry, but we added 36% to the budget to do this. And they underspent and missed out 700,000 people. That's huge.
Yeah, that is a massive amount of data gone. But in terms of the chief statistician, Liz McPherson, and James Shaw, I'm curious what you have thought about their response so far.
Oh, inadequate.
Mm-hmm.
Inadequate. What I sense is that it's we're coming, we'll have more information. But they've been saying that for months now. And it's time to move on. Just going back to boundaries alone, so MPs are going to get their boundaries drawn up apparently. We're saying, sorry, you shouldn't do that because the data is inadequate. So if we're going to rush headlong into drawing up a boundaries or allocating funding and it's on a substandard set of data, you can't get anything more fundamental than knowing who is in New Zealand.
Mm. And so I guess the question kind of is where to from here. If people haven't got their data and people haven't submitted the census, what does that mean?
Well, look, I think it's the process is closed off, so there isn't any second chance.
No.
But maybe we should be re-looking and redoing this whole thing. You've got to keep a real close eye on this stuff. Competency in terms of management. Ministers can't be across everything, but they should be across the fundamentals, and this is one.
Mm. And I might just shift on to our last question
day. She's smiling.
I love my personal questions. They're very insightful and interesting, I find, particularly with politicians.
Yeah.
But the question for today is, what is a relationship deal breaker for you?
Oh, no sense of humour.
Mm.
If the other person has no sense of humour, sorry. Oh, because you've got to, life's too short not to have a good laugh and not to smile and not to, yeah, no, if there's no humour, it's a turn off.
No, fair. Very, very high priority in my list as well.
Excellent.
Excellent. Beautiful. Well, thank you much,
Laura,
for joining me.
So cool to be in the studio.
Oh, so good to have you here. I might just play you out.
The National Party's Denise Lee on 95 BFM.